Let's use the last half hour for a few questions. And then this afternoon I want to talk about some of the social forms that give you support in this practice and be clear about what it is that our curriculum is. Talk a little bit about aging too. Questions? Thank you very much. Yeah.
This isn't turned on.
You don't need to. I'll repeat the question.
Okay. You might have a short answer, and that's okay. I saw in your newsletter that you're playing golf as a spiritual practice. And my question is, do you play golf differently than most people do?
A few years ago, as I move into the mid-60s of my life, I realized that I needed to change my style and get more exercise. And so the first thing I tried was Gold's Gym. And it was great because there were all these people with these, you know, huge pecs and lats, and they walk around like, you know, it's like a gorilla world. So I wasn't wearing my glasses, so I'm a little nearsighted. So they have mirrors around so you can sort of, you know, do this thing to yourself. After a while, because I couldn't see into the mirror, they were too far away, I began to think I was like these guys, you know, and I was like this. I mean, I like working out, actually. And I had a trainer, and one day she had just put me through a very intense exercise, and I was sitting there deciding whether to live or die, and she came up and she said, "Is everything all right?" And I knew she wouldn't ask one of them. At that moment, I knew I wasn't one of them. And I sort of decided I wanted to find something that would get me outside a little more. So I decided to take up golf again, which I had played when I was very young and was lousy then, and I'm lousy now. So I started to take lessons. And I became a very gung-ho golfer. But what I was interested in was that my consciousness has changed so much from when I played golf when I was a teenager that I almost immediately saw that this was a total mind game, that the technical stuff of the physical thing was not the dominant one. Although people focused on it a lot, the inner game was much more interesting as to where your consciousness was when you brought the club back and when you swung it through and where your awareness was and how, whether your model was to win or to distance or what you did with your consciousness. And I saw that it was no different from following my breath. And so I'd walk up to the ball and I would do a meditative thing and then the ball would do its thing. And then I would walk outside getting exercise and enjoying nature, and I'd come up to the next one and I'd do a meditative thing. So I'd meditate, walk, meditate, walk, meditate, walk. And my golf game improved immensely. And pretty soon my teacher and I had become playing buddies, and I was traveling down to Palm Springs to play all the fancy golf courses with threesome, foursomes. And every afternoon I'd go out to play and I'd be paired up with people, and they'd always be sort of retired Republicans. And hello, I'm Fred, and I'd say, hello, I'm Dick, and there was the sort of rules of the game, and every now and then at the golf course somebody would come up and say, Ramdas? like you've just been caught at some terrible, perverse occupation. You know, what are you doing here, you know? I'd say, I'm playing golf. So. Well, it turned out that there was a book that came out in the 60s called Golf and the Kingdom that Mike Murphy did, who started Esalen. And it had in it a mystical player, Shevis Irons, who was a kind of a mystic who taught golf. And in the wake of that book, which was sort of an underground cult book, they started an organization called the Shevis Irons Society, which is made up of mystical golfers. And so they heard that I was doing this, so they invited me to give the keynote address at their conference at Stanford. And I did, which was taped, and now it's like one of the hot tapes in the golf market. And I'm writing blurbs for golf books now. What's interesting about that to me is that I've gotten now to the point where I see that human beings are human beings, and my situation brings me in contact with human beings around a lot of different reasons. Sometimes it's the checkout counter at the supermarket. Sometimes it's somebody I'm playing golf with on the golf course. Sometimes it's somebody in the business community I'm working with. And I realize that when I get rid of my models about who you are, and my models about who I am, and just allow this to be an interaction, and then let the situation define it again, it all comes alive, and there's incredible spirit in each relationship, and I find I get fed incredibly by human relationships. I come away feeling very enriched by them, because I'm not trapped in the kind of narrowness. We play golf together. That's the vehicle for us to be together. We are souls who happen to be playing golf together. And I've been with people. I was with a guy recently. He was one of the meanest, most unhappy. Every shot he took, he swore. He actually threw his club by the second hole. And he was swearing and And I turned to him about the beginning of the second hole. I said, "You having fun?" And there was this... like I had encroached upon his privacy. And he said, "Yes." I said, "Good, I just wanted to make sure you were having fun, you know, that was all, just have it, enjoy yourself." And by the end of the round, he said, "I don't know who you are, but could we play again together?" And I just realized it is such fun to just dance in the forms of life and to meet people and allow the possibility that to me, all he was my guru in drag. I mean, you know, saying, "I bet you won't find me in this one." Questions? Yes.
Can you talk about finding motivation in service work?
Finding motivation in service work. Well, there are many and complex motivations for doing service. And one starts out often feeling the pain of other people's pain, or realizing you have the skill to do something to help somebody, and you are very busy somebody doing something for somebody else. And often it gives you a sense of well-being, a sense of being a good person for having done good work. That's all part of the psychosocial part of serving. As you work on your consciousness and extricate your awareness from so much heavy identification with your own separateness, you realize after a while that who you're serving is not her or him or them, but you begin to feel the nature of the interbeing, as Thich Nhat Hanh talks about it, the interconnections among things, and you realize that what you're serving is the suffering in us,
And that's a different motivation for serving them, serving us. And then as you go even deeper of extricating yourself from your own separateness even further, you come to a place where you see there's only one of it. And then it's serving yourself, really. And it's a little like if this finger pulls a splinter out of this finger doesn't say to this finger, thanks. And this finger doesn't say, aren't I good to have done this? Because they are both part of some central nervous system. And as your identity keeps changing inwardly, the nature of why you perform a compassionate act keeps changing outwardly. That at first you're doing it because you have the skill, the opportunity, and the feelings either of empathy for their suffering or of finding that's a good social role to be in, or it makes you feel better as a person to do it. Then as you go deeper, it gets to the point that it's nothing special. It's just suffering, and there's the response to suffering. And you're not, there's not personal involvement. I find myself doing what I do, and people say, aren't you good to do this much good? And that all is like so bizarre to me. I feel like saying, I'll tell him if I see him, you know. It has nothing to do with me. It's just the response you make. It's like when you need to go to the bathroom, or when you don't have to, people say, aren't you good to go to the bathroom? You maybe got that when you were a child, but I mean, that's years long past now, you know. And it's sort of the same thing. When there is pain, you respond to the pain because it hurts. We have protected ourselves from the suffering in the world by armoring our hearts because we feel it's too much suffering. And there are other ways to do that, to deal with suffering, so that you don't have to deny the reality of the present moment in order to be happy. And that's part of what our inner work is about, is to find the place in ourselves where we can look at the way the universe is without immediately imposing judgment to make ourselves feel good with ourselves. This is so interesting, to get to the point where you can say, my heart hates this suffering, it stinks. But there's another part of me that says, I just don't know. I don't know. Because my experience, personal experience, has been that my suffering, as much as I didn't want it when it was around, and I don't even want it now when it's around, I certainly see that it has been grace. It has deepened my being. And you find yourself in an interesting situation when you recognize that fact, that your suffering is the grace in the sense it's the stuff through which you can become free. You can use your suffering, because suffering shows the clinging of mind. You can use it to focus on that clinging, to let it go. But that doesn't lead you to be able to say to another person, your suffering is grace. You don't do that. And what you learn to do as a service person is live with this paradox, that you personally can know that for you suffering is grace, and yet for the other person you are relieving their suffering because they're experiencing that as suffering. And you can relieve it in such a way that they may say to you, why is it you don't seem to be suffering? And then you say, well, let me tell you, because suffering is grace for me. And then they say, could it be that for me? And you say, yes. And then we start on that. But generally, when people are suffering, they want you to relieve their immediate experience of suffering. And so you find yourself taking away the very things that could help them become free, because you have no moral right to decide what another person should do or not do. You can just create the environment where they can let go of the suffering as they are prepared to let go of it. And you do what you do to help them. And as you get deeper and wiser, your motivations change, until pretty soon you are just part of the web of the universe. You are part of the compassionate voice of the universe, the compassionate force, the dance of compassion and suffering that is always going on, part of the form of the world. Is that dealing with your question? Is that dealing with your question?
Ramdas, I was very identified with your struggle in the 60s that you were trying I wonder if you have any words about what is happening in the 90s in reference to ecologically, the planet doesn't seem to be sustainable anymore. Corporate is the new religion. Free market, so-called. There is more poverty looks around. I wonder if you can share with us any intuitions or reflections that you have about this current moment.
Did you all hear the question? He said that he was very sympathetic to what I was going through in the 60s, and he said, what about the 90s now? What's happening now? He said, it looks like there are some environmental darknesses, and there is some corporate greed, and there's a lot of stuff, and what's it look like now? I find the 90s extremely exciting, very scary, and very exciting. I have a wonderful friend, his name is John Seed, and I understand he will be through here in the spring sometime, and if you get a chance to hear him do, he's an Australian deep ecologist. He chains himself to trees and things like that. And so when I met him, and this is all on a videotape that's around and available too, you may get a chance to see it, an interview with John. And I said to John, John, where are we in this business about the trees? And as the way in which the trees are part of our atmosphere and affect our rain and so on, and our rainforest, where are we? And he said, well, Ramdas, he said, it's too late. And that really shook me up, that it's too late, that the inertia was so great. He said, it's like cattle running towards a cliff. And he said, you can't change it. So I was sitting there with a full impact of somebody who's a specialist in this field telling me that another thing is too late. And he looked at me, he said, you know, he said, it would take a miracle. He left a caveat, he left a door open. I said, aha. I said, what kind of a miracle would it take? He says, well, he said, you know, At some point, we came up out of the ocean onto dry land. He said, don't underestimate us. I said, oh, that kind of a miracle. I was talking to Robert Mueller. Robert Mueller is an interesting guy. He, for 38 years, he was in the United Nations. He was the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations for many years. And then he ran the Peace University down in Costa Rica. Beautiful man, a poet. I said, Robert, what about the environment? It's pretty scary. He said, well, he said, when we first had the first conference in Sweden around the environment, he said, no government had a department for the environment or representative. When we had the Rio conference a couple of years ago, he said there were 138 governments that had departments around the environment. He said, you know, don't underestimate the adaptation of people to circumstance just because it's a little slower than the minute you see the crisis. And that was interesting to me. I was part of an organization that Bobby Weir of the Grateful Dead started. It was called Creating Our Futures. Yeah, well, he was part of it. It was actually started by a Sikh fellow, Satsang Tub Sin. Made up of teenagers around environmental issues. And I realized that for teenagers, the environment was real as an issue, which for older people, it wasn't. They could import it, but it was not a natural thing. I grew up thinking that when you turned on the faucet, there would be clean water. When you went to the streams, there would be fresh fish. When you breathed the air, it would be safe.
and the changes are superimposed on a certain way of looking at the world for me. But these young people didn't grow up with that. So you can feel a generational shift in consciousness that's part of what we're talking about here. I looked around about 5-7 years ago and I saw that business was clearly the new power social institution, more so than religion, more so than schools, more so than even governments, because the multinationals now really thumb their noses at governments, and they are economically more stable than governments are. And at the invitation of a friend, I joined the board of an organization called the Social Venture Network, which was a group of business people that came together in order to see if business could be socially responsible around issues of justice and sustainability. And that has spawned a number of other organizations, Businesses for Social Responsibility, Students for Responsible Business in every business school now. This has all happened in a few years. Because the time is absolutely right when business people who are just like us, they are us, they feel the reality of the pain of the situations they're finding themselves in. Like untrammeled free market economy is increasing the polarization between rich and poor. And the numbers of rich are getting fewer and the number of poor are getting greater. And that's a destabilizing force in a society, in a world. And they realize that. They realize they are the problem. And their question is there a model for business that allows business to honor all of the stakeholders rather than just the stockholders? The stakeholders mean the community in which the business exists, the world community, the local community, the families, the generations, all of it. And they have to struggle with their own desire to hold on to their disproportionate rewards because it gives them power. It's their power base to do good. At the same moment, realizing that they are the problem, that this is part of the problem. And in the same way, when you've had a society that has used the incredible amount of resources that this society has used in relation to the world population, I mean, if you look at the world game, you see we are way out of proportion in terms of our use of resources. It's very hard when I go out and talk about or do stuff in books about voluntary simplicity, about people giving up their lifestyles for simpler ways of life that use less so that it's extremely hard for people to hear it. And that's what makes this moment so interesting. Because the interesting question is, do the changes that will occur, they must occur, because of population issues, environment, I mean, the non-sustainability of resources and so on, whether the shift will require trauma of such a proportion that it will destabilize the whole game and it will fall apart, like a major depression or something like that, which will really upset the balance, or revolution or something like that, that kind of force. I mean, at one point it looked like the LA riots were the leading edge of something so horrendous that the next time it would take Beverly Hills with it, you know, and Brentwood and all that. But you see now that there are balances going on within society, and it's tricky to both to not be naive, to deny the fear and greed in people and how that works. But it's also, I think, not right to deny the power of the reasoning processes of human beings and the power of their compassion. I think we don't focus much on that stuff because we're so dealing with the greed all the time, things like that. But I feel these forces are very, very alive at the moment in the situation. And when John Seed said it would take a miracle, what I heard was it would take a shift of collective consciousness. And that intrigues me, because shifts of collective consciousness don't require a hell of a lot. We don't even know how they happen. But they do happen in history, where something shifts and suddenly people are willing. Like I remember in the Second World War, our family, you know, Dad was an air raid spotter and Mother was making bundles for Britain, and I was an air raid spotter and I was 14 or something like that. We all were delighted to give up everything and gas stamps, and we even didn't use them, and it was a... And people were thrown together, but the trauma, that was a traumatic situation. Clear enemy, evil. That isn't what's being given to us now. The enemy is within ourselves. And I don't really see the kind of consciousness in looking, for example, in watching the campaigns for the last election, I don't see the kind of two-level consciousness that's necessary for the shift that we're talking about in the political arena. I mean, I think Bill Clinton's very smart. I think he's a very smart guy. I don't think he's a wise person. I think he's a smart person. And that's painful to me. I would like him to be a wise person. Because what we need is wisdom. And that voice that will speak will be a voice of wisdom, not of smartness. And it's not a solution that cleverness will do. It's a solution that simplicity will realize. So I sit at the point where I see that it is clear that something profound has happened, and it's happened from the 60s onward. I think an incredible thing happened, and I think we are still experiencing the fallout from all of it. And that consciousness issue that happened in the 60s is in us. We haven't figured out how to manifest it, how to integrate it into our lives. So we are still living our lives externally with mythology that is dysfunctional for our own survival. And that's a very interesting predicament to find ourselves in. And I think anybody that will resonate with that, like I'm doing here with you, is heard. We're hearing each other. Because we know this situation. What we will do about it, or whether we will do enough